I'm so stoked that Mike Marolt is here with us today, because through Mike, I get a glimpse of adventurings to places beyond my imagination. Mike Marolt is a fourth-generation Aspenite, where he is raising part of the fifth generation of Marolts with his wife, Shelley. For his passion, he has spent his life since age 12 climbing and skiing mountains. He has spent the last 30 years exploring the greater ranges with a concentration on ski descents in the 5,000 to 8,000-meter peaks. In 2017, Mike and his brother Steve became the first ski mountaineers to be inducted into the United States Ski and Snowboard Hall of Fame. He has written and produced several films and is an op-ed writer for various ski magazines. His first book, Natural Progression, is due out this summer, followed by a second one next year. Let's put our hands together and welcome Mike Marolt.
It was 4 a.m., on July 4th, 1972, my father walked into my bedroom and he flipped the light on. Then he went down the hall and he did the same thing to my brothers. And we were only 12 years old. Roger was a little bit older. But we didn't have any problems getting up that morning because the night before, Dad told us we were going skiing. So we got up, we hurried downstairs, had some breakfast, and then we all loaded up into the old Ford LTD station wagon. And Dad cranked up the engine, and we drove east up towards Independence Pass. So we pulled into the parking lot at the top, and the sun wasn't up yet, but it was light out, and we could see that there were no clouds. And Dad said, guys, we got a great day. So we were really pumped up, and we got out, and we put our skis on our shoulders. There was no AT gear at that time. And he pointed out to the gentle rise where we were headed, and we our adrenaline just spiked, and we just started running. And Dad said, hold on, guys. He said, if you're going faster than you can enjoy the natural wilderness, you're going too fast. And he gave us our first lessons on altitude and conserving energy. He got in front and slowed the pace down. So we marched on up the hill, and before we knew it, we were at the top. Right as the sun came over the eastern skyline and it started to grace the slopes of this bowl called 4th of July Bowl, which got its namesake from a generation of skiers before us that had started a tradition where Aspenites that just couldn't get enough skiing would go up to Independence Pass and ski on the 4th of July. So it was called the 4th of July Bowl. So he also said, we got to wait a few minutes for the snow to soften up, because if you get on those steep slopes and you fall, you'll slide into the rocks. So we had some water and we took some sips of water, and then Dad said, okay, guys, let's go. So we clicked into our skis, and we pushed off, and the first few turns were a little sketchy because we hadn't skied since April, but it's kind of like riding a bike. And after a few more turns, we found ourselves just arcing these turns down this incredible face, and it was just this perfect corn snow. And we got to the bottom, and Dad said, we got to find a snow bridge to get over the river, which was, completely full with the runoff. And then we hiked back over to the other side of the road, and Dad stuck his thumb out and started hitchhiking, which was a little odd because they said, don't hitchhike, guys. And he explained that he had to go get the car. So we accepted that as an exception to the rule. So Dad came back, and we piled back into the old station wagon, and as we were driving off, I'll never forget looking at that slope and looking at our tracks coming down it. And that, for a 12-year-old, was a big deal, and for me, that cemented in my mind, that's what I want to do with my life. Dad was an Olympic skier, but I wanted to be a ski mountaineer. And Dad was really excited, too, because he wanted to continue skiing with us, and he loved doing that. And he said, well, let's do this a couple more times, and later on in the summer, I can take you up Montezuma Basin, which is a permanent snow field where, when he was young, he used to train for his ski racing. So the summer rolled into August, and this time we loaded into the old 48 Willys Jeep, and we drove up Castle Creek, got on the Jeep road that took us up to about 12,000 feet, to a little parking lot up there where these beautiful snow slopes rolled down almost to the bumper. So we shouldered our skis and we booted up several hundred feet, and we came to this big flat basin. It was like a big frozen football field up there. And in the middle of this basin, there was this bulge that came up, and in that bulge was an ice lake. And Dad said, you guys have got to go check this out. So we climbed up to the rim, and the blue sky reflected against the white snow in the bottom. And it just left an impression on us. And we continued skiing there the rest of that summer. And Montezuma Basin, as it did for my dad, kind of became a base camp for us. And we found ourselves up there because it was year-round skiing, especially in the summer months. And that would become the base camp from the time we could drive that would send us off to Alaska and the Andes in South America and to Asia. We often used to comment because it was so fortunate to have an asset like that so close that it was really an unfair advantage for us. So we started to grow older and we progressed with our passion and we found ourselves in Alaska and South America and Asia. And as we grew, we slowly began to appreciate the natural world. But a funny thing happened. We would be on a peak in South America, and before we were off that peak, we'd look out and we'd see another huge volcano or something, and we'd say, we got to go there. So we found ourselves in these places, and then later on, we would be going back. In other examples, we would be on a peak, and we wouldn't be able to finish it, so we would vow to come back. So we found ourselves in these incredible mountain scenery places where we saw the highest peaks in the world in these massive glaciers. We were exposed to different cultures. We got to see how the cultures lived from the natural world. And as we grew, we transformed from complete mountain ski junkies into individuals that really appreciated the natural world. And we progressed to a point where we finally found ourselves ready to take on the Big E, Everest. So in 2003, we planned an expedition. We were ragtag cheap. We didn't have any big base camps or anything, and we couldn't afford guides. So we had to research everything before we got there. And on that route between base camp at about 17,000 and 23,000, we knew there were some pitfalls. We knew we had to cross an ice river, and then we knew we had to cross under a huge hanging serac. So, you know, we were a little bit nervous. We showed up, and, you know, being the wise mountaineers that we thought we were, we would go early in the morning to take advantage of the freeze. So we started hiking up the trail. And we came up to a little crest, and our jaws just dropped. Before us, there were miles of these penitentes, these huge 100-foot penitentes there, formations of ice that get formed from the wind and the sun. And it looked like a carpet of these just giant shark's teeth just stretching up the glacier for miles. And there was no way to get around them. And that's why the trail forced us to have to cross this river. Now, this river was from the melt-off, and it formed a half pipe several feet deep. And it was just a raging torrent that just went into this hole into the ice. So you couldn't fall, because if you fell, there was no way that you'd be saved. So we chipped out some steps, got across that, and then the next obstacle, we looked up, and 2,000 feet above us, there was this huge hanging serac wall. I mean, this was a hanging serac cliff that was as big as small mountains in Colorado. Well, long story short, we didn't have success on that trip, and this is one of those peaks where we decided that we wanted to come back. So we planned a trip for 4 years later. We found ourselves back at North Camp on Mount Everest. And for 4 years, the fear of these things was just building up, almost to the point where I wanted to back out. But I reasoned myself into it. And so here we are on the trail, my fear enhanced even more by the fact that I could remember specific rocks on the trail from 4 years before. So we came and we crested over that same little rise, and our jaws just dropped, but not for the same reason. All of those penitentes had melted, leaving miles of completely flat glacial dust with a little trickle of water that we just stepped across. So we carried on and continued up the glacier, waiting for the next big obstacle, and we couldn't find this massive cliff, and we just couldn't understand it. And then we came around another corner, and Steve said, "Oh my God, look at that. This huge serac cliff had melted into a smear of ice that wasn't catapulting huge blocks of ice across the trail below, but was just dripping water." So in 4 years, it went from this huge avalanche that you had to really be careful crossing to absolutely nothing. It was so drastic in 4 years that it was the type of scenario that if you didn't actually see it, there's no possible way you could believe that many millions and millions of cubic feet of ice could just disappear. But we continued with our passion, and another example of this, we had seen this guidebook for this peak called Chimborazo in Peru. And this guidebook was written in the late 80s and 90s. And it showed these magnificent glaciers coming all the way down this face from 21,000 feet all the way down to base camp. And it was just a must for skiing. And we said, we got to go there. But when we got there, half of that face had melted out into a complete shamble of ice and water ice and pumice rock embedded into it. And the guidebook didn't say anything about, you know, ice equipment. So we couldn't climb the peak. It was just too melted out. But we did climb up to a ridge, and we were really excited because we came across this glacier off the backside. And this glacier was just magnificent, and it just flowed for miles out onto the Peruvian plain, and we skied it. And it got us excited enough that we wanted to come back and finish the peak. So 3 years later, we came back. We looked up at this face. It had melted out even more. We had the right equipment. We climbed to the top. We got a really great ski descent. And on the way down, we said, let's go over to that ridge and ski the glacier and get some more skiing. So we made our way over to the ridge. And when we got to it, this glacier that just 3 years before had meandered out onto the Peruvian plain was basically a snowfield, a quarter in length, and not even worth skiing. So these are just a couple examples, but I mean, in the 30 years that we've been in the greater ranges, I mean, I could write a book on these examples that show how quickly the glaciers are disappearing. But the thing that I want to emphasize here, you don't have to go to Alaska or the Andes or Asia. You can see the same drastic effects right here in our backyard. For example, if you go up to Montezuma Basin now in August, don't bring your skis because there's no snow. It melts out by that time. And that beautiful basin that used to have a bulge 50 to 100 feet, that has actually collapsed into a crater a couple hundred feet deep with no ice because all of the ice has melted away. But for me personally, because it was such an initial attraction to the sport, the thing that hurts me the most is 4th of July bowl. That used to be a staple, a tradition. And now if you want to ski that bowl, you have to hit it by no later than the middle of May. So everything is melting. Everything is warming up. And I think that through all of these micro experiences over the last few decades, it's really given me a connection to what climate change is really all about. And unfortunately, in my opinion, based on what I'm reading about it, if anything, it's a lot more drastic than I think a lot of people realize. Thank you.